The fourth commandment. Thus far we have learned the first three commandments, which relate to God. First, that with our whole heart we trust in Him, and fear and love Him throughout all our life. Secondly, that we do not misuse His holy name in the support of falsehood or any bad work, but employ it to the praise of God and the profit and salvation of our neighbor and ourselves. Thirdly, that on holidays and when at rest we diligently treat and urge God's word, so that all our actions and our entire life be ordered according to it. Now follow the other seven, which relate to our neighbor, among which the first and greatest is, Thou shalt honor thy father and thy mother. To this estate of fatherhood and motherhood, God has given the special distinction above all estates that are beneath it, that He not simply commands us to love our parents, but to honor them. With respect to brothers, sisters, and our neighbors in general, He commands nothing higher than that we love them, so that He separates and distinguishes father and mother above all other persons upon earth, and places them at His side. For it is a far higher thing to honor than to love one, inasmuch as it comprehends not only love, but also modesty, humility, and deference as to a majesty there hidden, and requires not only that they be addressed kindly and with reverence, but, most of all, that both in heart and with the body, we so act as to show that we esteem them very highly, and that, next to God, we regard them as the very highest. For one whom we are to honor from the heart, we must truly regard as high and great. We must, therefore, impress it upon the young that they should regard their parents as in God's stead, and remember that however lowly, poor, frail, and queer they may be, nevertheless they are father and mother given them by God. They are not to be deprived of their honor because of their conduct or their failings. Therefore, we are not to regard their persons, how they may be, but the will of God who has thus created and ordained. In other respects, we are, indeed, all alike in the eyes of God. But among us there must necessarily be such inequality and order difference, and therefore God commands it to be observed, that you obey me as your father, and that I have the supremacy. Learn, therefore, first what is the honor toward parents required by this commandment, to wit, that they be held in distinction and esteem above all things, as the most precious treasure on earth. Furthermore, that also in our words we observe modesty toward them, do not accost them roughly, haughtily, and defiantly, but yield to them and be silent, even though they go too far. Thirdly, that we show them such honor also by works, that is, with our body and possessions, that we serve them, help them, and provide for them when they are old, sick, infirm, or poor, and that not only gladly, but with humility and reverence, as doing it before God. For he who knows how to regard them in his heart will not allow them to suffer want or hunger, but will place them above him and at his side, and will share with them whatever he has and possesses. Secondly, notice how great, good, and holy a work is here assigned children, which, alas, utterly neglected and disregarded, and no one perceives that God has commanded it, or that it is a holy, divine word and doctrine. For if it had been regarded as such, everyone could have inferred that they must be holy men who live according to these words. Thus, there would have been no need of inventing monasticism nor spiritual orders, but every child would have abided by this commandment, and could have directed his conscience to God and said, If I am to do good and holy works, I know of none better than to render all honor and obedience to my parents, because God has himself commanded it. For what God commands must be much and far nobler than everything that we may devise ourselves. And since there is no higher or better teacher to be found than God, there can be no better doctrine, indeed, than he gives forth. Now, he teaches fully what we should do if we wish to perform truly good works, and by commanding them, he shows that they please him. If, then, it is God who commands this, and who knows not how to appoint anything better, I will never improve upon it. Behold, in this manner we would have had a godly child properly taught, reared in true blessedness, and kept at home in obedience to his parents and in their service, so that men should have had blessing and joy from the spectacle. However, God's commandment was not permitted to be thus, with such care and diligence, commended, but had to be neglected and trampled underfoot, so that a child could not lay it to heart, and meanwhile gaped like a panting wolf at the devices which we set up, without once consulting or giving reverence to God. Let us, therefore, learn at last, for God's sake, that, placing all other things out of sight, our youths look first to this commandment, if they wish to serve God with truly good works, that they do what is pleasing to their fathers and mothers, or to those to whom they may be subject in their stead. For every child that knows and does this has, in the first place, this great consolation in his heart, that he can joyfully say and boast, in spite of and against all who are occupied with works of their own choice, "Behold, this work is well-pleasing to my God in heaven, that I know for certain." Let them all come together with their many great, distressing, and difficult works and make their boast. We will see whether they can show one that is greater and nobler than obedience to father and mother, to whom God has appointed and commanded obedience next to his own majesty, so that if God's word and will are in force and being accomplished, nothing shall be esteemed higher than the will and word of parents. Yet so that it too is subordinated to obedience toward God and is not opposed to the preceding commandments. Therefore you should be heartily glad and thank God that he has chosen you and made you worthy to do a work so precious and pleasing to him. Only see that, although it be regarded as the most humble and despised, you esteem it great and precious, not on account of our worthiness, but because it is comprehended in and controlled by the jewel and sanctuary, namely, the word and commandment of God. Oh, what a high price would all Carthusians, monks, and nuns pay if in all their religious doings they could bring into God's presence a single work done by virtue of his commandment and be able before his face to say with joyful heart, "Now I know that this work is well-pleasing to thee." Where will these poor wretched persons hide when in the sight of God and all the world they shall blush with shame before a young child who has lived according to this commandment and shall have to confess that with their whole life they are not worthy to give it a drink of water? And it serves them right for their devilish perversion in treading God's commandment underfoot, that they must vainly torment themselves with works of their own device, and, in addition, have scorn and loss for their reward. Should not the heart, then, leap and melt for joy when going to work and doing what is commanded, saying, "Lo, this is better than all holiness of the Carthusians, even though they kill themselves fasting and praying upon their knees without ceasing"? For here you have a sure text and a divine testimony that he has enjoined this, but concerning the other he did not command a word. But this is the plight and miserable blindness of the world, that no one believes these things. To such an extent the devil has deceived us with false holiness and the glamour of our own works. Therefore, I would be very glad, I say it again, if men would open their eyes and ears and take this to heart, lest some time we may again be led astray from the pure word of God to the lying vanities of the devil. Then, too, all would be well, for parents would have more joy, love, friendship, and concord in their houses. Thus the children would captivate their parents' hearts. On the other hand, when they are obstinate and will not do what they ought until a rod is laid upon their back, they anger both God and their parents, whereby they deprive themselves of this treasure and joy of conscience, and lay up for themselves only misfortune. Therefore, as everyone complains, the course of the world now is such that both young and old are altogether dissolute and beyond control, have no reverence nor sense of honor, do nothing except as they are driven to it by blows, and perpetrate what wrong and detraction they can behind each other's back. Therefore God also punishes them, that they sink into all kinds of filth and misery. As a rule, the parents too are themselves stupid and ignorant. One fool trains or teaches another, and as they have lived, so live their children after them. This, now, I say, should be the first and most important consideration to urge us to the observance of this commandment, on which account, if we had no father and mother, we ought to wish that God would set up wood and stone before us, whom we might call father and mother. How much more, since he has given us living parents, should we rejoice to show them honor and obedience, because we know it is so highly pleasing to the divine majesty and to all angels, and vexes all devils, and is, besides, the highest work which we could do after the sublime divine worship comprehended in the previous commandments, so that giving of alms and every other good work toward our neighbor are not equal to this. For God has assigned this estate the highest place, yea, has set it up in his own stead upon earth. This will and pleasure of God ought to be a sufficient reason and incentive to us to do what we can with good will and pleasure. Besides this, it is our duty before the world to be grateful for benefits and every good which we have of our parents. But here again the devil rules in the world, so that the children forget their parents, as we all forget God, and no one considers how God nourishes, protects, and defends us, and bestows so much good on body and soul, especially when an evil hour comes. We are angry and grumble with impatience, and all the good which we have received throughout our life is wiped out from our memory. Just so we do also with our parents, and there is no child that understands and considers this, what parents have endured while nourishing and fostering him, except the Holy Ghost grant him this grace. God knows very well this perverseness of the world. Therefore he admonishes and urges by commandments that everyone consider what his parents have done for him, and he will find that he has from them body and life. Moreover, that he has been fed and reared when otherwise he would have perished 100 times in his own filth. Therefore it is a true and good saying of old and wise men, to God, to parents, and to teachers, we can never render sufficient gratitude and compensation. He that regards and considers this will indeed, without compulsion, do all to honor his parents, and bear them up on his hands as those through whom God has done him all good. Over and above all this, another great reason that should incite us the more to obedience to this commandment is that God attaches to this commandment a temporal promise and says that thou mayest live long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Here you can see yourself how much God is in earnest in respect to this commandment, inasmuch as he not only declares that it is well-pleasing to him, and that he has joy and delight therein, but also that it shall be for our prosperity and promote our highest good, so that we may have a pleasant and agreeable life, furnished with every good thing. Therefore, also, St. Paul greatly emphasizes the same and rejoices in it when he says, Ephesians 6, 2 and 3, this is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. For although the rest also have their promises contained in them, yet in none is it so plainly and explicitly stated. Here, then, you have the fruit and the reward, that whoever observes this commandment shall have happy days, fortune, and prosperity, and on the other hand, the punishment, that whoever is disobedient shall the sooner perish and never enjoy life. For to have long life in the sense of the Scriptures is not only to become old, but to have everything which belongs to long life, such as health, wife and children, livelihood, peace, good government, etc., without which this life can neither be enjoyed in cheerfulness nor long endure. If, therefore, you will not obey father and mother and submit to their discipline, then obey the hangman. If you will not obey him, then submit to the skeleton man, i.e. death, the all-subduer, the teacher of wicked children. For on this God insists peremptorily. Either if you obey him, rendering love and service, he will reward you abundantly with all good, or if you offend him, he will send upon you both death and the hangman. Whence come so many knaves that must daily be hanged, beheaded, broken upon the wheel, but from disobedience to parents? Because they will not submit to discipline in kindness, so that by the punishment of God, they bring it about that we behold their misfortune and grief. For it seldom happens that such perverse people die a natural or timely death. But the godly and obedient have this blessing, that they live long in pleasant quietness and see their children's children, as said above, to the third and fourth generation. Thus, experience also teaches that where there are honorable old families who fare well and have many children, they owe their origin to the fact, to be sure, that some of them were brought up well and were regardful of their parents. On the other hand, it is written of the wicked, Psalm 109, verse 13, let his posterity be cut off, and in the generation following let their name be blotted out. Therefore, heed well how great a thing in God's sight obedience is, since he so highly esteems it, is so highly pleased with it, and rewards it so richly, and besides enforces punishment so rigorously on those who act contrariwise. All this I say, that it may be well impressed upon the young. For no one believes how necessary this commandment is, although it has not been esteemed and taught hitherto under the papacy. These are simple and easy words, and everybody thinks he knew them afore. Therefore men pass them lightly by, are gaping after other matters, and do not see and believe that God is so greatly offended if they be disregarded, nor that one does a work so well-pleasing and precious if he follows them. In this commandment belongs a further statement regarding all kinds of obedience to persons in authority who have to command and to govern. For all authority flows and is propagated from the authority of parents. For where a father is unable alone to educate his rebellious and irritable child, he employs a schoolmaster to instruct him. If he be too weak, he enlists the aid of his friends and neighbors. If he departs this life, he delegates and confers his authority and government upon others who are appointed for the purpose. Likewise, he must have domestics, manservants, and maidservants under himself for the management of the household, so that all whom we call masters are in the place of parents and must derive their power and authority to govern from them. Hence also they are all called fathers in the Scriptures, as those who in their government perform the functions of a father, and should have a paternal heart toward their subordinates, as also from antiquity the Romans and other nations called the masters and mistresses of the household house fathers and house mothers. So also they called their national rulers and overlords fathers of the entire country. For a great shame to us who would be Christians that we do not likewise call them so, or at least do not esteem and honor them as such. Now, what a child owes to father and mother, the same owe all who are embraced in the household. Therefore, manservants and maidservants should be careful not only to be obedient to their masters and mistresses, but also to honor them as their own fathers and mothers, and to do everything which they know is expected of them, not from compulsion and with reluctance, but with pleasure and joy for the cause just mentioned, namely, that it is God's command and is pleasing to him above all other works. Therefore, they ought rather to pay wages in addition, and be glad that they may obtain masters and mistresses to have such joyful consciences, and to know how they may do truly golden works, a matter which has hitherto been neglected and despised, when, instead, everybody ran, in the devil's name, into convents or to pilgrimages and indulgences, with loss of time and money, and with an evil conscience. If this truth, then, could be impressed upon the poor people, a servant girl would leap and praise and thank God, and with her tidy work for which she receives support and wages, she would obtain such a treasure as all that are esteemed the greatest saints have not attained. Is it not an excellent boast to know and say that if you perform your daily domestic task, this is better than all the sanctity and ascetic life of monks? And you have the promise, in addition, that you shall prosper in all good and fare well. How can you lead a more blessed or holier life as far as your works are concerned? For in the sight of God, faith is what really renders a person holy, and alone serves him. But the works are for the service of man. There you have everything good, protection and defense in the Lord, a joyful conscience, and a gracious God besides, who will reward you a hundredfold, so that you are even a nobleman if you be only pious and obedient. But if not, you have, in the first place, nothing but wrath and displeasure of God, no peace of heart, and afterwards all manner of plagues and misfortunes. Whoever will not be influenced by this and inclined to godliness, we hand over to the hangman and to the skeleton man. Therefore, let everyone who allows himself to be advised remember that God is not making sport, and know that it is God who speaks with you and demands obedience. If you obey him, you are his dear child. If you despise to do it, then take shame, misery, and grief for your reward. The same also is to be said of obedience to civil government, which, as we have said, is all embraced in the estate of fatherhood and extends farthest of all relations. For here the father is not one of a single family, but of as many people as he has tenants, citizens, or subjects. For through them, as through our parents, God gives to us food, house and home, protection and security. Therefore, since they bear such name and title with all honor as their highest dignity, it is our duty to honor them and to esteem them great as the dearest treasure and the most precious jewel upon earth. He, now, who is obedient here, is willing and ready to serve, and cheerfully does all that pertains to honor, knows that he is pleasing God, and that he will receive joy and happiness for his reward. If he will not do it in love, but despises and resists authority, or rebels, let him also know, on the other hand, that he shall have no favor nor blessing. And where he thinks to gain a florin thereby, he will elsewhere lose 10 times as much, or become a victim to the hangman, perish by war, pestilence, and famine, or experience no good in his children, and be obliged to suffer injury, injustice, and violence at the hands of his servants, neighbors or strangers, and tyrants, so that what we seek and deserve is paid back and comes home to us. If we would ever suffer ourselves to be persuaded that such works are pleasing to God, and have so rich a reward, we would be established in altogether abundant possessions and have what our heart desires. But because the word and command of God are so lightly esteemed, as though some babbler had spoken it, let us see whether you are the man to oppose him. How difficult, do you think, it will be for him to recompense you? Therefore, you would certainly live much better with the divine favor, peace, and happiness than with his displeasure and misfortune. Why, think you, is the world now so full of unfaithfulness, disgrace, calamity, and murder? But because every one desires to be his own master and free from the emperor, to care nothing for anyone and do what pleases him? Therefore, God punishes one knave by another, so that when you defraud and despise your master, another comes and deals in like manner with you. Yea, in your household you must suffer 10 times more from wife, children, or servants. Indeed, we feel our misfortune, we murmur and complain of unfaithfulness, violence, and injustice, but we will not see that we ourselves are knaves who have fully deserved this punishment, and yet are not thereby reformed. We will have no favor and happiness. Therefore, it is but fair that we have nothing but misfortune without mercy. There must still be somewhere upon earth some godly people, because God continues to grant us so much good. On our own account, we should not have a farthing in the house, nor a straw in the field. All this I have been obliged to urge with so many words, in hope that someone may take it to heart, that we may be relieved of the blindness and misery in which we are steeped so deeply, and may truly understand the word and will of God, and earnestly accept it. For thence we would learn how we could have joy, happiness, and salvation enough, both temporal and eternal. Thus we have 2 kinds of fathers presented in this commandment, fathers in blood and fathers in office, or those to whom belongs the care of the family and those to whom belongs the care of the country. Besides these, there are yet spiritual fathers, not like those in the papacy who have indeed had themselves called thus, but have performed no function of the paternal office. For those only are called spiritual fathers who govern and guide us by the word of God, as St. Paul boasts his fatherhood, 1 Corinthians 4:15, where he says, "In Christ Jesus I have begotten you through the gospel." Now, since they are fathers, they are entitled to their honor, even above all others. But here it is bestowed least, For the way which the world knows for honoring them is to drive them out of the country and to grudge them a piece of bread, and, in short, they must be, as says St. Paul, 1 Corinthians 4:13, as the filth of the world and everybody's refuse and foot rag. Yet there is need that this also be urged upon the populace, that those who would be Christians are under obligation in the sight of God to esteem them worthy of double honor who minister to their souls, that they deal well with them and provide for them. For that, God is willing to add to you sufficient blessing and will not let you come to want. But in this matter, everyone refuses and resists, and all are afraid that they will perish from bodily want, and cannot now support one respectable preacher, where formerly they filled 10 fat paunches. In this we also deserve that God deprive us of his word and blessing, and again allow preachers of lies to arise to lead us to the devil, and, in addition, to drain our sweat and blood. But those who keep in sight God's will and commandment have the promise that everything which they bestow upon temporal and spiritual fathers, and whatever they do to honor them, shall be richly recompensed to them, so that they have not bread, clothing, and money for a year or two, but long life, support, and peace, and shall be eternally rich and blessed. Therefore, only do what is your duty, and let God take care how he is to support you and provide for you sufficiently. Since he has promised it and has never yet lied, he will not be found lying to you. This ought indeed to encourage us and give us hearts that would melt in pleasure and love toward those to whom we owe honor, so that we would raise our hands and joyfully thank God who has given us such promises, for which we ought to run to the ends of the world, to the remotest parts of India. For although the whole world should combine, it would not add an hour to our life or give us a single grain from the earth. But God wishes to give you all exceeding abundantly according to your heart's desire. He who despises and casts this to the winds is not worthy ever to hear a word of God. This has now been stated more than enough for all who belong under this commandment. In addition, it would be well to preach to the parents also, and such as bear their office, as to how they should deport themselves toward those who are committed to them for their government. For although this is not expressed in the Ten Commandments, it is nevertheless abundantly enjoined in many places in the Scripture, and God desires to have it embraced in this commandment when he speaks of father and mother. For he does not wish to have in this office and government knaves and tyrants, nor does he assign to them this honor, that is, power and authority to govern, that they should have themselves worshipped, but they should consider that they are under obligations of obedience to God, and that, first of all, they should earnestly and faithfully discharge their office, not only to support and provide for the bodily necessities of their children, servants, subjects, etc., but, most of all, to train them to the honor and praise of God. Therefore, do not think that this is left to your pleasure and arbitrary will, but that it is a strict command and injunction of God, to whom also you must give account for it. But here again, the sad plight arises that no one perceives or heeds this, and all live on as though God gave us children for our pleasure or amusement, and servants that we should employ them like a cow or ass, only for work, or as though we were only to gratify our wantonness with our subjects, ignoring them as though it were no concern of ours what they learn or how they live. And no one is willing to see that this is the command of the Supreme Majesty, who will most strictly call us to account and punish us for it. nor that there is so great a need to be so seriously concerned about the young. For if we wish to have excellent and apt persons both for civil and ecclesiastical government, we must spare no diligence, time, or cost in teaching and educating our children, that they may serve God and the world, and we must not think only how we may amass money and possessions for them, for God can indeed, without us, support and make them rich, as he daily does. But for this purpose he has given us children, and issued this command, that we should train and govern them according to his will, else he would have no need of father and mother. Let everyone know, therefore, that it is his duty, on peril of losing the divine favor, to bring up his children above all things in the fear and knowledge of God. And if they are talented, have them learn and study something, that they may be employed for whatever need there is, to have them instructed and trained in a liberal education, that men may be able to have their aid in government and in whatever is necessary. If that were done, God would also richly bless us and give us grace to train men by whom land and people might be improved, and likewise well-educated citizens, chaste and domestic wives, who afterwards would rear godly children and servants. Here, consider what deadly injury you are doing if you be negligent and fail on your part to bring up your child to usefulness and piety, and how you bring upon yourself all sin and wrath, thus earning hell by your own children, even though you be otherwise pious and holy. And because this is disregarded, God so fearfully punishes the world that there is no discipline, government, or peace, of which we all complain, but do not see that it is our fault. For as we train them, we have spoiled and disobedient children and subjects. Let this be sufficient exhortation, for to draw this out at length belongs to another time. The fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill. We have now completed both the spiritual and the temporal government, that is, the divine and the paternal authority and obedience. But here now we go forth from our house among our neighbors to learn how we should live with one another, every one himself toward his neighbor. Therefore, God and government are not included in this commandment, nor is the power to kill, which they have taken away. For God has delegated his authority to punish evildoers to the government instead of parents, who aforetime, as we read in Moses, were required to bring their own children to judgment and sentence them to death. Therefore, what is here forbidden is forbidden to the individual in his relation to anyone else, and not to the government. Now, this commandment is easy enough, and has been often treated, because we hear it annually in the Gospel of St. Matthew, chapter 5, verses 21 and following, where Christ himself explains and sums it up, namely, that we must not kill, neither with hand, heart, mouth, signs, gestures, help, nor counsel. Therefore, it is here forbidden to everyone to be angry, except those, as we said, who are in the place of God, that is, parents and the government. For it is proper for God and for everyone who is in a divine estate to be angry, to reprove and punish, namely, on account of those very persons who transgress this and the other commandments. But the cause and need of this commandment is that God well knows that the world is evil, and that this life has much unhappiness. Therefore, he has placed this and the other commandments between the good and the evil. Now, as there are many assaults upon all commandments, so it happens also in this commandment, that we must live among many people who do us harm, so that we have cause to be hostile to them. As when your neighbor sees that you have a better house and home, a larger family and more fertile fields, greater possessions and fortune from God than he is sulky, envies you, and speaks no good of you. Thus, by the devil's incitement, you will get many enemies who cannot bear to see you have any good, either bodily or spiritual. When we see such people, our hearts, in turn, would rage and bleed and take vengeance. Then there arise cursing and blows, from which follow finally misery and murder. Here, now, God, like a kind father, steps in ahead of us, interposes, and wishes to have the quarrel settled, that no misfortune come of it, nor one destroy another. And briefly, he would hereby protect, set free, and keep in peace everyone against the crime and violence of everyone else, and would have this commandment placed as a wall, fortress, and refuge about our neighbor, that we do him no hurt nor harm in his body. Thus, this commandment aims at this, that no one offend his neighbor on account of any evil deed, even though he have fully deserved it. For where murder is forbidden, all cause also is forbidden, whence murder may originate. For many a one, although he does not kill, yet curses and utters a wish, which would stop a person from running far if it were to strike him in the neck, makes imprecations, which, if fulfilled with respect to anyone, he would not live long. Now, since this inheres in everyone by nature, and it is a common practice that no one is willing to suffer at the hands of another, God wishes to remove the root and source by which the heart is embittered against our neighbor, and to accustom us ever to keep in view this commandment, always to contemplate ourselves in it as in a mirror, to regard the will of God, and with hearty confidence and invocation of his name, to commit to him the wrong which we suffer. Thus, we shall suffer our enemies to rage and be angry, do what they can, and we learn to calm our wrath, and to have a patient, gentle heart, especially toward those who give us cause to be angry, that is, our enemies. Therefore, the entire sum of what it means not to kill is to be impressed most explicitly upon the simple-minded. In the first place, that we harm no one, first, with our hand or by deed, then, that we do not employ our tongue to instigate or counsel thereto. Further, that we neither use nor assent to any kind of means or methods whereby anyone may be injured. And finally, that the heart be not ill disposed toward anyone, nor from anger and hatred wish him ill, so that body and soul may be innocent in regard to everyone, but especially those who wish you evil or inflict such upon you. For to do evil to one who wishes and does you good is not human, but diabolical. Secondly, under this commandment, not only he is guilty who does evil to his neighbor, but he also who can do him good, prevent, resist evil, defend and save him, so that no bodily harm or hurt happen to him, and yet does not do it. If, therefore, you send away one that is naked when you could clothe him, you have caused him to freeze to death. If you see one suffer hunger and do not give him food, you have caused him to starve. So also, if you see anyone innocently sentenced to death or in like distress and do not save him, although you know ways and means to do so, you have killed him. And it will not avail you to make the pretext that you did not afford any help, counsel, or aid thereto, for you have withheld your love from him and deprived him of the benefit whereby his life would have been saved. Therefore, God also rightly calls all those murderers who do not afford counsel and help in distress and danger of body and life, and will pass a most terrible sentence upon them in the last day, as Christ himself has announced when he shall say, Matthew 25:42, I was hungry, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. Naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. That is, you have suffered me and mine to die of hunger, thirst, and cold, would have suffered the wild beast to tear us to pieces, or left us to rot in prison, or perish in distress. What else is that but to reproach them as murderers and bloodhounds? For although you have not actually done all this, you have nevertheless, so far as you were concerned, suffered him to pine and perish in misfortune. It is just as if I saw someone navigating and laboring in deep water and struggling against adverse winds, or one fallen into fire and could extend to him the hand to pull him out and save him, and yet refused to do it. What else would I appear, even in the eyes of the world, than as a murderer and a criminal? Therefore, it is God's ultimate purpose that we suffer harm to befall no man, but show him all good and love, and, as we have said, it is specially directed toward those who are our enemies, for to do good to our friends is but an ordinary heathen virtue, as Christ says, Matthew 5:46. Here we have again the word of God, whereby he would encourage and urge us to true, noble, and sublime works, as gentleness, patience, and, in short, love and kindness to our enemies, and would ever remind us to reflect upon the first commandment, that he is our God, that is, he will help, assist, and protect us, in order that he may thus quench the desire of revenge in us. This we ought to practice and inculcate, and we would have our hands full doing good works. But this would not be preaching for monks. It would greatly detract from the religious estate and infringe upon the sanctity of Carthusians, and would even be regarded as forbidding good works and clearing the convents. For in this wise, the ordinary state of Christians would be considered just as worthy, and even worthier, and everybody would see how they mock and delude the world with a false, hypocritical show of holiness, because they have given this or other commandments to the winds, and have esteemed them unnecessary, as though they were not commandments, but mere counsels, and have at the same time shamelessly proclaimed and boasted their hypocritical estate and works as the most perfect life, in order that they might lead a pleasant, easy life, without the cross and without patience, for which reason, too, they have resorted to the cloisters, so that they might not be obliged to suffer any wrong from anyone or to do him any good. But know now that these are the true, holy, and godly works, in which, with all the angels, he rejoices, in comparison with which all human holiness is but stench and filth, and besides, deserves nothing but wrath and damnation. The sixth commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. These commandments now that follow are easily understood from the explanation of the preceding, for they are all to the effect that we be careful to avoid doing any kind of injury to our neighbor, but they are arranged in fine, elegant order. In the first place, they treat of his own person. Then they proceed to the person nearest him, or the closest possession next after his body, namely, his wife, who is one flesh and blood with him, so that we cannot inflict a higher injury upon him in any good that is his. Therefore, it is explicitly forbidden here to bring any disgrace upon him in respect to his wife, and it really aims at adultery, because among the Jews it was ordained and commanded that everyone must be married. Therefore also the young were early provided for, or married, so that the virgin state was held in small esteem. Neither were public prostitution and lewdness tolerated as now. Therefore, adultery was the most common form of unchastity among them. But because among us there is such a shameful mess, and the very dregs of all vice and lewdness, this commandment is directed also against all manner of unchastity, whatever it may be called. And not only is the external act forbidden, but also every kind of cause, incitement, and means, so that the heart, the lips, and the whole body may be chaste and afford no opportunity, help, or persuasion to inchastity. And not only this, but that we also make resistance, afford protection and rescue wherever there is danger and need, and again, that we give help and counsel so as to maintain our neighbor's honor. For whenever you omit this, when you could make resistance, or connive at it as if it did not concern you, you are as truly guilty as the one perpetrating the deed. Thus, to state it in the briefest manner, there is required this much, that everyone both live chastely himself and help his neighbor to do the same, so that God, by this commandment, wishes to hedge round about and protect, as with a rampart, every spouse, that no one trespass against them. But since this commandment is aimed directly at the state of matrimony, and gives occasion to speak of the same, you must well understand and mark, first, how gloriously God honors and extols this estate, inasmuch as by his commandment he both sanctions and guards it. He has sanctioned it above in the fourth commandment, honor thy father and thy mother. But here he has, as we said, hedged it about and protected it. Therefore, he also wishes us to honor it, and to maintain and conduct it as a divine and blessed estate, because, in the first place, he has instituted it before all others, and therefore created man and woman separately, as is evident, not for lewdness, but that they should legitimately live together, be fruitful, beget children, and nourish and train them to the honor of God. Therefore, God has also most richly blessed this estate above all others, and, in addition, has bestowed on it and wrapped up in it everything in the world, to the end that this estate might be well and richly provided for. Married life is therefore no jest or presumption, but it is an excellent thing, and a matter of divine seriousness, for it is of the highest importance to him that persons be raised who may serve the world and promote the knowledge of God, godly living, and all virtues, to fight against wickedness and the devil. Therefore, I have always taught that this estate should not be despised nor held in disrepute, as is done by the blind world and our false ecclesiastics, but that it be regarded according to God's word, by which it is adorned and sanctified, so that it is not only placed on an equality with other estates, but that it precedes and surpasses them all, whether they be that of emperor, princes, bishops, or whoever they please. For both ecclesiastical and civil estates must humble themselves, and all be found in this estate, as we shall hear. Therefore, it is not a peculiar estate, but the most common and noblest estate, which pervades all Christendom, yea, which extends through all the world. In the second place, you must know also that it is not only an honorable, but also a necessary state, and it is solemnly commanded by God that, in general, in all conditions, men and women who were created for it shall be found in this estate. Yet with some exceptions, although few, whom God has especially accepted, so that they are not fit for the married estate, or whom he has released by a high supernatural gift, that they can maintain chastity without this estate. For where nature has its course, as it is implanted by God, it is not possible to remain chaste without marriage. For flesh and blood remain flesh and blood, and the natural inclination and excitement have their course without let or hindrance, as everybody sees and feels. In order, therefore, that it may be the more easy in some degree to avoid unchastity, God has commanded the estate of matrimony, that everyone may have his proper portion and be satisfied therewith, although God's grace besides is required in order that the heart also may be pure. From this you see how this popish rabble, priests, monks, and nuns, resist God's order and commandment, inasmuch as they despise and forbid matrimony, and presume and vow to maintain perpetual chastity, and, besides, deceive the simple-minded with lying words and appearances. For no one has so little love and inclination to chastity as just those who, because of great sanctity, avoid marriage, and either indulge in open and shameless prostitution, or secretly do even worse, so that one dare not speak of it, as has, alas, been learned too fully. And, in short, even though they abstain from the act, their hearts are so full of unchaste thoughts and evil lusts that there is a continual burning and secret suffering, which can be avoided in the married life. Therefore, all vows of chastity out of the married state are condemned by this commandment, and free permission is granted, yea, even the commandment is given, to all poor ensnared consciences, which have been deceived by their monastic vows, to abandon the unchaste state and enter the married life, considering that even if the monastic life were godly, it would nevertheless not be in their power to maintain chastity, and if they remain in it, they must only sin more and more against this commandment. Now, I speak of this in order that the young may be so guided that they conceive a liking for the married estate, and know that it is a blessed estate and pleasing to God. For in this way we might, in the course of time, bring it about that married life be restored to honor, and that there might be less of the filthy, dissolute, disorderly doings which now run riot the world over in open prostitution and other shameful vices arising from disregard of married life. Therefore, it is the duty of parents and the government to see to it that our youth be brought up to discipline and respectability, and when they have come to years of maturity, to provide for them to have them married in the fear of God and honorably. He would not fail to add his blessing and grace, so that men would have joy and happiness from the same. Let me now say, in conclusion, that this commandment demands not only that everyone live chastely in thought, word, and deed in his condition, that is, especially in the estate of matrimony, but also that everyone love and esteem the spouse given him by God. For where conjugal chastity is to be maintained, man and wife must by all means live together in love and harmony, that one may cherish the other from the heart, and with entire fidelity. For that is one of the principal points which enkindle love and desire of chastity, so that where this is found, chastity will follow as a matter of course, without any command. Therefore also Saint Paul so diligently exhorts husband and wife to love and honor one another. Here you have again a precious, yea, many and great good works, of which you can joyfully boast against all ecclesiastical estates chosen without God's word and commandment. The seventh commandment: Thou shalt not steal. After your person and spouse, temporal property comes next. That also God wishes to have protected, and He has commanded that no one shall subtract from or curtail his neighbor's possessions. For to steal is nothing else than to get possession of another's property wrongfully, which briefly comprehends all kinds of advantage in all sorts of trade to the disadvantage of our neighbor. Now, this is indeed quite a widespread and common vice, but so little regarded and observed that it exceeds all measure. So that if all who are thieves, and yet do not wish to be called such, were to be hanged on gallows, the world would soon be devastated, and there would be a lack both of executioners and gallows. For as we have just said, to steal is to signify not only to empty our neighbor's coffer and pockets, but to be grasping in the market, in all stores, booths, wine and beer sellers, workshops, and in short, wherever there is trading or taking and giving of money for merchandise or labor. As, for instance, to explain this somewhat grossly for the common people, that it may be seen how godly we are. When a manservant or maidservant does not serve faithfully in the house and does damage, or allows it to be done when it could be prevented, or otherwise ruins and neglects the goods entrusted to him, from indolence, idleness, or malice, to the spite and vexation of master and mistress, and in whatever way this can be done purposely, for I do not speak of what happens from oversight and against one's will, you can in a year abscond 30-40 florins, which if another had taken secretly or carried away, he would be hanged with the rope. But here you, while conscious of such a great theft, may even bid defiance and become insolent, and no one dare call you a thief. The same I say also of mechanics, workmen, and day laborers, who all follow their wanton notions and never know enough ways to overcharge people, while they are lazy and unfaithful in their work. All these are far worse than sneak thieves, against whom we can guard with locks and bolts, or who, if apprehended, are treated in such a manner that they will not do the same again. But against these no one can guard. No one dare even look awry at them or accuse them of theft, so that one would 10 times rather lose from his purse. For here are my neighbors, good friends, my own servants, from whom I expect good, every faithful and diligent service, who defraud me first of all. Furthermore, in the market and in common trade, likewise, this practice is in full swing and force to the greatest extent. Where one openly defrauds another with bad merchandise, false measures, weights, coins, and by nimbleness and queer finances or dexterous tricks, takes advantage of him. Likewise, when one overcharges a person in a trade and wantonly drives a hard bargain, skins and distresses him. And who can recount or think of all these things? To sum up, this is the commonest craft and the largest guild on earth. And if we regard the world throughout all conditions of life, it is nothing else than a vast, wide stall full of great thieves. Therefore they are also called swivel chair robbers, land and highway robbers, not picklocks and sneak thieves who snatch away the ready cash, but who sit on the chair at home and are styled great noblemen and honorable, pious citizens, and yet rob and steal under a good pretext. Yes, here we might be silent about the trifling individual thieves if we were to attack the great, powerful arch-thieves with whom lords and princes keep company, who daily plunder not only a city or two, but all Germany. Yea, where should we place the head and supreme protector of all thieves, the holy chair at Rome, with all its retinue? which has grabbed by theft the wealth of all the world and holds it to this day. This is, in short, the course of the world. Whoever can steal and rob openly goes free and secure, unmolested by anyone, and even demands that he be honored. Meanwhile, the little sneak thieves who have once trespassed must bear the shame and punishment to render the former godly and honorable. But let them know that in the sight of God they are the greatest thieves, and that he will punish them as they are worthy and deserve. Now, since this commandment is so far-reaching and comprehensive, as just indicated, it is necessary to urge it well and to explain it to the common people, not to let them go on in their wantonness and security, but always to place before their eyes the wrath of God and inculcate the same. For we have to preach this not to Christians, but chiefly to knaves and scoundrels, to whom it would be more fitting for judges, jailers, or Master Haynes, the executioner, to preach. Therefore, let everyone know that it is his duty, at the risk of God's displeasure, not only to do no injury to his neighbor, nor to deprive him of gain, nor to perpetrate any act of unfaithfulness or malice in any bargain or trade, but faithfully to preserve his property for him, to secure and promote his advantage, especially when one accepts money, wages, and one's livelihood for such service. He now who wantonly despises this may indeed pass along and escape the hangman, but he shall not escape the wrath and punishment of God. And when he has long practiced his defiance and arrogance, he shall yet remain a tramp and beggar, and, in addition, have all plagues and misfortune. Now you are going your way, wherever your heart's pleasure calls you, while you ought to preserve the property of your master and mistress, for which service you fill your crop and maw. Take your wages like a thief, have people treat you as a nobleman, for there are many that are even insolent towards their masters and mistresses, and are unwilling to do them a favor or service by which to protect them from loss. But reflect what you will gain when, having come into your own property and being set up in your own home, to which God will help all misfortunes, it will bob up again and come home to you, and you will find that where you have cheated or done injury to the value of one mite, you will have to pay 30 again. Such shall be the lot also of mechanics and day laborers, of whom we are now obliged to hear and suffer such intolerable maliciousness, as though they were noblemen in another's possessions, and every one were obliged to give them what they demand. Just let them continue practicing their exactions as long as they can, but God will not forget his commandment, and will reward them according as they have served, and will hang them, not upon a green gallows, but upon a dry one, so that all their life they shall neither prosper nor accumulate anything. And indeed, if there were a well-ordered government in the land, such wantonness might soon be checked and prevented, as was the custom in ancient times among the Romans, where such characters were promptly seized by the pate in a way that others took warning. No more shall all the rest prosper who change the open free market into a carrion pit of extortion and a den of robbery, where the poor are daily overcharged, new burdens and high prices are imposed, and everyone uses the market according to his caprice, and is even defiant and brags as though it were his fair privilege and right to sell his goods for as high a price as he pleased, and no one had a right to say a word against it. We will indeed look on and let these people skin, pinch, and hoard, but we will trust in God, who will, however, do this of his own accord, that, after you have been skinning and scraping for a long time, he will pronounce such a blessing on your gains that your grain in your garner, your beer in the cellar, Your cattle in the stalls shall perish. Yea, where you have cheated and overcharged anyone to the amount of a florin, your entire pile shall be consumed with rust, so that you shall never enjoy it. And indeed, we see and experience this being fulfilled daily before our eyes, that no stolen or dishonestly acquired possession thrives. How many there are who rake and scrape day and night, and yet grow not a farthing richer. And though they gather much, they must suffer so many plagues and misfortunes that they cannot relish it with cheerfulness, nor transmit it to their children. But as no one minds it, and we go on as though it did not concern us, God must visit us in a different way and teach us manners by imposing one taxation after another, or billeting a troop of soldiers upon us who in 1 hour empty our coffers and purses and do not quit as long as we have a farthing left, and in addition, by way of thanks, burn and devastate house and home, and outrage and kill wife and children. And in short, if you steal much, depend upon it that again as much will be stolen from you. And he who robs and acquires with violence and wrong will submit to one who shall deal after the same fashion with him. For God is master of this art, that since everyone robs and steals from the other, he punishes one thief by means of another. Else where should we find enough gallows and ropes? Now, whoever is willing to be instructed, let him know that this is the commandment of God, and that it must not be treated as a jest. For although you despise us, defraud, steal, and rob, we will indeed manage to endure your haughtiness, suffer, and according to the Lord's Prayer, forgive and show pity. For we know that the godly shall nevertheless have enough, and you injure yourself more than another. But beware of this. When the poor man comes to you, of whom there are so many now, who must buy with the penny of his daily wages and live upon it, and you are harsh to him, as though everyone lived by your favor, and you skin and scrape to the bone, and, besides, with pride and haughtiness, turn him off to whom you ought to give for nothing. He will go away wretched and sorrowful, and since he can complain to no one, he will cry and call to heaven. Then beware, I say again, as of the devil himself, for such groaning and calling will be no jest, but will have a weight that will prove too heavy for you and all the world. For it will reach him who takes care of the poor, sorrowful hearts, and will not allow them to go unavenged. But if you despise this and become defiant, see whom you have brought upon you. If you succeed and prosper, you may before all the world call God and me a liar. We have exhorted, warned, and protested enough. He who will not heed or believe it may go on until he learns this by experience. Yet it must be impressed upon the young that they may be careful not to follow the old lawless crowd, but keep their eyes fixed upon God's commandment, lest his wrath and punishment come upon them too. It behooves us to do no more than to instruct and reprove with God's word, but to check such open wantonness, there is need of the princes and government, who themselves would have eyes and the courage to establish and maintain order in all manner of trade and commerce, lest the poor be burdened and oppressed, nor themselves be loaded with other men's sins. Let this suffice as an explanation of what stealing is, that it be not taken too narrowly, but made to extend as far as we have to do with our neighbors. And briefly, in a summary, as in the former commandments, it is herewith forbidden, in the first place, to do our neighbor any injury or wrong in whatever manner supposable by curtailing, forestalling, and withholding his possessions and property, or even to consent or allow such a thing, but to interpose and prevent it. And on the other hand, it is commanded that we advance and improve his possessions, and in case he suffers want, that we help, communicate, and lend both to friends and foes. Whoever now seeks and desires good works will find here more than enough, such as are heartily acceptable and pleasing to God, and in addition are favored and crowned with excellent blessings, that we are to be richly compensated for all that we do for our neighbor's good and from friendship, as also King Solomon teaches, Proverbs 19:17, "He that hath pity upon the poor lendeth unto the Lord, and that which he hath given will he pay him again." Here, then, you have a rich Lord, who is certainly sufficient for you, and who will not suffer you to come short in anything or to want. Thus you can, with a joyful conscience, enjoy 100 times more than you could scrape together with unfaithfulness and wrong. Now, whoever does not desire the blessing will find wrath and misfortune enough. The 8th commandment: Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Over and above our own body, spouse, and temporal possessions, we have yet another treasure, namely, honor and good report, with which we cannot dispense. For it is intolerable to live among men in open shame and general contempt. Therefore God wishes the reputation, good name, and upright character of our neighbor to be taken away or diminished as little as his money and possessions, that everyone may stand in his integrity before wife, children, servants, and neighbors. And, in the first place, we take the plainest meaning of this commandment according to the words, "Thou shalt not bear false witness," as pertaining to the public courts of justice, where a poor innocent man is accused and oppressed by false witnesses in order to be punished in his body, property, or honor. Now, this appears as if it were of little concern to us at present, but with the Jews it was quite a common and ordinary matter. For the people were organized under an excellent and regular government, and where there is still such a government, instances of this sin will not be wanting. The cause of it is that where judges, burgomasters, princes, or others in authority sit in judgment, things never fail to go according to the course of the world. Namely, men do not like to offend anybody, flatter and speak to gain favor, money, prospects, or friendship, and in consequence, a poor man and his cause must be oppressed, denounced as wrong, and suffer punishment. And it is a common calamity in the world that in courts of justice there seldom preside godly men. For to be a judge requires above all things a godly man, and not only a godly, but also a wise, modest, yea, a brave and bold man. Likewise, to be a witness requires a fearless and especially a godly man. For a person who is to judge all matters rightly and carry them through with his decision will often offend good friends, relatives, neighbors, and the rich and powerful who can greatly serve or injure him. Therefore, he must be quite blind, have his eyes and ears closed, neither see nor hear, but go straight forward in everything that comes before him and decide accordingly. Therefore, this commandment is given first of all that everyone shall help his neighbor to secure his rights and not allow them to be hindered or twisted, but shall promote and strictly maintain them, no matter whether he be judge or witness, and let it pertain to whatsoever it will. And especially is a goal set up here for our jurists, that they be careful to deal truly and uprightly with every case, allowing right to remain right, and, on the other hand, not perverting anything by their tricks and technical points, turning black into white and making wrong out of right, nor glossing it over or keeping silent concerning it, irrespective of a person's money, possession, honor, or power. This is one part and the plainest sense of this commandment concerning all that takes place in court. Next, it extends very much further. If we are to apply it to spiritual jurisdiction or administration, here it is a common occurrence that everyone bears false witness against his neighbor. For wherever there are godly preachers and Christians, they must bear the sentence before the world that they are called heretics, apostates, yea, seditious and desperately wicked miscreants. Besides, the word of God must suffer in the most shameful and malicious manner, being persecuted, blasphemed, contradicted, perverted, and falsely cited and interpreted. But let this pass, for it is the way of the blind world that she condemns and persecutes the truth and the children of God, and yet esteems it no sin. In the third place, what concerns us all, this commandment forbids all sins of the tongue, whereby we may injure or approach too closely to our neighbor. For to bear false witness is nothing else than a work of the tongue. Now, whatever is done with the tongue against a fellow man, God would have prohibited, whether it be false preachers with their doctrine and blasphemy, false judges and witnesses with their verdict, or outside of court by lying and evil speaking. Here belongs particularly the detestable, shameful vice of speaking behind a person's back and slandering, to which the devil spurs us on, and of which there would be much to be said. For it is a common evil plague that everyone prefers hearing evil to hearing good of his neighbor. And although we ourselves are so bad that we cannot suffer that anyone should say anything bad about us, but everyone would much rather that all the world would speak of him in terms of gold, yet we cannot bear that the best is spoken about others. Therefore, to avoid this vice, we should note that no one is allowed publicly to judge and reprove his neighbor, although he may see him sin, unless he have a command to judge and to reprove. For there is a great difference between these two things, judging sin and knowing sin. You may indeed know it, but you are not to judge it. I can indeed see and hear that my neighbor sins, but I have no command to report it to others. Now, if I rush in, judging and passing sentence, I fall into a sin which is greater than his. But if you know it, do nothing else than turn your ears into a grave and cover it, until you are appointed to be judge and to punish by virtue of your office. Those, then, are called slanderers who are not content with knowing a thing, but proceed to assume jurisdiction, and when they know a slight offense of another, carry it into every corner, and are delighted and tickled that they can stir up another's displeasure, as swine roll themselves in the dirt and root in it with the snout. This is nothing else than meddling with the judgment and office of God, and pronouncing sentence and punishment with the most severe verdict. For no judge can punish to a higher degree, nor go farther than to say, he is a thief, a murderer, a traitor, etc. Therefore, whoever presumes to say the same of his neighbor goes just as far as the emperor and all governments. For although you do not wield the sword, you employ your poisonous tongue to the shame and hurt of your neighbor. God, therefore, would have it prohibited that anyone speak evil of another, even though he be guilty, and the latter know it right well, much less if he do not know it, and have it only from hearsay. But you say, shall I not say it if it be the truth? Answer, why do you not make accusation to regular judges? Ah, I cannot prove it publicly, and hence I might be silenced and turned away in a harsh manner. Ah, indeed, do you smell the roast? If you do not trust yourself to stand before the proper authorities and to make answer, then hold your tongue. But if you know it for yourself and not for another. For if you tell it to others, although it be true, you will appear as a liar, because you cannot prove it. And you are, besides, acting like a knave. For we ought never to deprive anyone of his honor or good name, unless it first be taken away from him publicly. False witness, then, is everything which cannot be properly proved. Therefore, what is not manifest upon sufficient evidence, no one shall make public or declare for truth. And, in short, whatever is secret should be allowed to remain secret, or, at any rate, should be secretly reproved, as we shall hear. Therefore, if you encounter an idle tongue which betrays and slanders someone, contradict such a one promptly to his face, that he may blush. Thus many a one will hold his tongue, who else would bring some poor man into bad repute, from which he would not easily extricate himself. For honor and a good name are easily taken away, but not easily restored. Thus you see that it is summarily forbidden to speak any evil of our neighbor. However, the civil government, preachers, father and mother excepted, on the understanding that this commandment does not allow evil to go unpunished. Now, as according to the fifth commandment, no one is to be injured in body, and yet Master Haynes, the executioner, is excepted, who by virtue of his office does his neighbor no good, but only evil and harm, and nevertheless does not sin against God's commandment, because God has on his own account instituted that office, for he has reserved punishment for his own good pleasure, as he threatens in the first commandment. Just so also, although no one has a right in his own person to judge and condemn anybody, yet if they, to whose office it belongs, fail to do it, they sin as well as he who would not do so of his own accord, without such office. For here necessity requires one to speak of the evil, to prefer charges, to investigate and testify. And it is not different from the case of a physician who is sometimes compelled to examine and handle the patient whom he is to cure in secret parts. Just so governments, father and mother, brothers and sisters, and other good friends are under obligation to each other to reprove evil wherever it is needful and profitable. But the true way in this matter would be to observe the order according to the gospel, Matthew 18:15, where Christ says, "If thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone." Here you have a precious and excellent teaching for governing well the tongue, which is to be carefully observed against this detestable misuse. Let this, then, be your rule, that you do not too readily spread evil concerning your neighbor and slander him to others, but admonish him privately, that he may amend his life. Likewise also, if someone report to you what this or that one has done, teach him, too, to go and admonish him personally, if he has seen it himself, but if not, that he hold his tongue. The same you can learn also from the daily government of the household, for when the master of the house sees that the servant does not do what he ought, he admonishes him personally. But if he were so foolish as to let the servant sit at home and went on the streets to complain of him to his neighbors, he would no doubt be told, "Well, you fool, what does that concern us? Why do you not tell it to him?" Behold, that would be acting quite brotherly, so that the evil would be stayed and your neighbor would retain his honor. As Christ also says in the same place, If he hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. Then you have done a great and excellent work. For do you think it is a little matter to gain a brother? Let all monks and holy orders step forth, with all their works melted together into one mass, and see if they can boast that they have gained a brother. Further, Christ teaches, but if he will not hear thee, then take with thee one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. So he whom it concerns is always to be treated with personally, and not to be spoken of without his knowledge. But if that do no avail, then bring it publicly before the community, whether before the civil or the ecclesiastical tribunal. For then you do not stand alone, but you have those witnesses with you by whom you can convict the guilty one, relying on whom the judge can pronounce sentence and punish. This is the right and regular course for checking and reforming a wicked person. But if we gossip about another in all corners and stir the filth, no one will be reformed, and afterwards, when we are to stand up and bear witness, we deny having said so. Therefore, it would serve such tongues right if their itch for slander were severely punished as a warning to others. If you were acting for your neighbor's reformation or from love of the truth, you would not sneak about secretly nor shun the day and the light. All this has been said regarding secret sins, but where the sin is quite public, so that the judge and everybody know it, you can, without any sin, avoid him and let him go, because he has brought himself into disgrace, and you may also publicly testify concerning him. For when a matter is public in the light of day, there can be no slandering or false judging or testifying, as when we now reprove the Pope with his doctrine, which is publicly set forth in books and proclaimed in all the world. For where the sin is public, the reproof also must be public, that everyone may learn to guard against it. Thus we have now the sum and general understanding of this commandment, to wit, that no one do any injury with the tongue to his neighbor, whether friend or foe, nor speak evil of him, no matter whether it be true or false, unless it be done by commandment or for his reformation, but that everyone employ his tongue and make it serve for the best of everyone else, to cover up his neighbor's sins and infirmities, excuse them, palliate them, and garnish them with his own reputation. The chief reason for this should be the one which Christ alleges in the Gospel, in which he comprehends all commandments respecting our neighbor, Matthew 7:12, "Whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them." Even nature teaches the same thing in our bodies, as St. Paul says, 1 Corinthians 12:22, "Much more, those members of the body which seem to be more feeble are necessary, and those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, upon these we bestow more abundant honor, and our uncomely parts have more abundant comeliness. No one covers his face, eyes, nose, and mouth, for they, being in themselves the most honorable members which we have, do not require it. But the most infirm members, of which we are ashamed, we cover with all diligence. Hands, eyes, and the whole body must help to cover and conceal them. Thus also among ourselves should we adorn whatever blemishes and infirmities we find in our neighbor, and serve and help him to promote his honor to the best of our ability, and, on the other hand, prevent whatever may be discreditable to him. And it is especially an excellent and noble virtue for one always to explain advantageously and put the best construction upon all he may hear of his neighbor, if it be not notoriously evil, or at any rate to condone it over and against the poisonous tongues that are busy wherever they can pry out and discover something to blame in a neighbor, and that explain and pervert it in the worst way, as is done now, especially with the precious word of God and its preachers. There are comprehended, therefore, in this commandment, quite a multitude of good works, which please God most highly, and bring abundant good and blessing, if only the blind world and the false saints would recognize them. For there is nothing on or in entire man which can do both greater and more extensive good or harm in spiritual and in temporal matters than the tongue, though it is the least and feeblest member. The 9th and 10th commandments. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his cattle, nor anything that is his. These two commandments are given quite exclusively to the Jews. Nevertheless, in part they also concern us, for they do not interpret them as referring to unchastity or theft, because these are sufficiently forbidden above. They also thought that they had kept all those when they had done or not done the external act. Therefore, God has added these two commandments in order that it be esteemed as sin and forbidden to desire or in any way to aim at getting our neighbor's wife or possessions. And especially because under the Jewish government, manservants and maidservants were not free as now to serve for wages as long as they pleased, but were their master's property with their body and all they had, as cattle and other possessions. Moreover, every man had power over his wife to put her away publicly by giving her a bill of divorce, and to take another. Therefore, they were in constant danger among each other that if one took a fancy to another's wife, he might allege any reason both to dismiss his own wife and to estrange the other's wife from him, that he might obtain her under pretext of right. That was not considered a sin nor disgrace with them, as little as now with hired help, when a proprietor dismisses his manservant or maidservant, or takes another's servants from him in any way. Therefore, I say, they thus interpreted these commandments, and that rightly, although their scope reaches somewhat farther and higher, that no one think or purpose to obtain what belongs to another, such as his wife, servants, house and estate, land, meadows, cattle, even with a show of right or by a subterfuge, yet with injury to his neighbor. For above, in the 7th commandment, the vice is forbidden where one wrests to himself the possessions of others or withholds them from his neighbor, which he cannot do by right. But here it is also forbidden to alienate anything from your neighbor, even though you could do so with honor in the eyes of the world, so that no one could accuse or blame you as though you had obtained it wrongfully. For we are so inclined by nature that no one desires to see another have as much as himself, and each one acquires as much as he can. The other may fare as best he can. And yet we pretend to be godly, know how to adorn ourselves most finely, and conceal our rascality, resort to and invent adroit devices and deceitful artifices, such as now are daily most ingenuously contrived, as though they were derived from the law codes. Yea, we even dare impertinently to refer to it and boast of it, and will not have it called rascality, but shrewdness and caution. In this, lawyers and jurists assist, who twist and stretch the law to suit it to their cause, stress words, and use them for a subterfuge, irrespective of equity or their neighbor's necessity. And, in short, whoever is the most expert and cunning in these affairs finds most help in law, as they themselves say, the laws favor the watchful. This last commandment, therefore, is given not for rogues in the eyes of the world, but just for the most pious, who wish to be praised and be called honest and upright people, since they have not offended against the former commandments, as especially the Jews claim to be, and even now many great noblemen, gentlemen, and princes. For the other common masses belong yet farther down, under the seventh commandment, as those who are not much concerned whether they acquire their possessions with honor and right. Now, this occurs most frequently in cases that are brought into court, where it is the purpose to get something from our neighbor and to force him out of his own. As, to give examples, when people quarrel and wrangle about a large inheritance, real estate, etc., they avail themselves of and resort to whatever has the appearance of right, so dressing and adorning everything that the law must favor their side, and they keep the property with such title that no one can make complaint or lay claim thereto. In like manner, if anyone desire to have a castle, city, duchy, or any other great thing, he practices so much financiering through relationships and by any means he can, that the other is judicially deprived of it, and it is adjudicated to him, and confirmed with deed and seal, and declared to have been acquired by princely title and honesty. Likewise, also in common trade, where one dexterously slips something out of another's hand, so that he must look after it, or surprises and defrauds him in a matter in which he sees advantage and benefit for himself, so that the latter, perhaps on account of distress or debt, cannot regain or redeem it without injury, and the former gains the half or even more. And yet this must not be considered as acquired by fraud or stolen, but honestly bought. Here they say, first come, first served, and everyone must look to his own interest. Let another get what he can. And who can be so smart as to think of all the ways in which one can get many things into his possession by such specious pretexts? This the world does not consider wrong, nor is it punished by laws, and will not see that the neighbor is thereby placed at a disadvantage and must sacrifice what he cannot spare without injury. Yet there is no one who wishes this to be done to him, from which we can easily perceive that such devices and pretexts are false. Thus it was done formerly also with respect to wives. They knew such devices, that if one were pleased with another woman, he personally or through others, as there were many ways and means to be invented, caused her husband to conceive a displeasure toward her, or had her resist him and so conduct herself that he was obliged to dismiss her and leave her to the other. That sort of thing undoubtedly prevailed much under the law, as also we read in the Gospel of King Herod, that he took his brother's wife while he was yet living, and yet wished to be thought an honorable, pious man, as Saint Mark also testifies of him. But such an example, I trust, will not occur among us, because in the New Testament, those who are married are forbidden to be divorced, except in such a case where one shrewdly, by some stratagem, takes away a rich bride from another. But it is not a rare thing with us that one estranges or alienates another's manservant or maidservant, or entices them away by flattering words. In whatever way such things happen, we must know that God does not wish that you deprive your neighbor of anything that belongs to him, so that he suffer the loss and you gratify your avarice with it, even if you could keep it honorably before the world. for it is a secret and insidious imposition practiced under the hat, as we say, that it may not be observed. For although you go your way as if you had done no one any wrong, you have nevertheless injured your neighbor. And if it is not called stealing and cheating, yet it is called coveting your neighbor's property. That is, aiming at possession of it, enticing it away from him without his will, and being unwilling to see him enjoy what God has granted him. And although the judge and everyone must leave you in possession of it, yet God will not leave you therein. For he sees the deceitful heart and the malice of the world, which is sure to take an L in addition wherever you yield to her a finger's breadth. And at length, public wrong and violence follow. Therefore, we allow these commandments to remain in their ordinary meaning, that it is commanded, first, that we do not desire our neighbor's damage, nor even assist, nor give occasion for it, but gladly wish and leave him what he has, and, besides, advance and preserve for him what may be for his profit and service, as we should wish to be treated. Thus, these commandments are especially directed against envy and miserable avarice, God wishing to remove all causes and sources whence arises everything by which we do injury to our neighbor. And therefore he expresses it in plain words, thou shalt not covet, etc. For he would especially have the heart pure, although we shall never attain to that as long as we live here, so that this commandment will remain, like all the rest, one that will constantly accuse us and show how godly we are in the sight of God. Conclusion of the Ten Commandments. Thus we have the Ten Commandments, a compend of divine doctrine, as to what we are to do in order that our whole life may be pleasing to God, and the true fountain and channel from and in which everything must arise and flow that is to be a good work, so that outside of the Ten Commandments, no work or thing can be good or pleasing to God, however great or precious it be in the eyes of the world. Let us see now what our great saints can boast of their spiritual orders and their great and grievous works, which they have invented and set up, while they let these pass as though they were far too insignificant or had long ago been perfectly fulfilled. I am of opinion, indeed, that here one will find his hands full and will have enough to do to observe these, namely, meekness, patience, and love towards enemies, chastity, kindness, etc., and what such virtues imply. But such works are not of value and make no display in the eyes of the world, for they are not peculiar and conceited works, and restricted to particular times, places, rites, and customs, but are common, everyday domestic works which one neighbor can practice toward another. Therefore, they are not of high esteem. But the other works cause people to open their eyes and ears wide, and men aid to this effect by great display, expense, and magnificent buildings with which they adorn them, so that everything shines and glitters. There they waft incense, they sing and ring bells, they light tapers and candles, so that nothing else can be seen or heard. For when a priest stands there in a surplice embroidered with gilt, or a layman continues all day upon his knees in church, that is regarded as a most precious work, which no one can sufficiently praise. But when a poor girl tends a little child and faithfully does what she is told, that is considered nothing. For else, what should monks and nuns seek in their cloisters? But see, is it not a cursed presumption of those desperate saints who dare to invent a higher and better life and estate than the Ten Commandments teach, pretending, as we have said, that this is an ordinary life for the common man, but that theirs is for saints and perfect ones. And the miserable blind people do not see that no man can get so far as to keep one of the Ten Commandments as it should be kept. But both the Apostles' Creed and the Lord's Prayer must come to our aid, as we shall hear, by which that power and strength to keep the commandments is sought and prayed for and received continually. Therefore, all their boasting amounts to as much as if I boasted and said, "To be sure, I have not a penny to make payment with, but I confidently undertake to pay 10 florins. All this I say and urge in order that men might become rid of the sad misuse which has taken such deep root and still cleaves to everybody, and in all estates upon earth become used to looking hither only, and to being concerned about these matters. For it will be a long time before they will produce a doctrine or estates equal to the Ten Commandments, because they are so high that no one can attain to them by human power, and whoever does attain to them is a heavenly angelic man far above all holiness of the world. Only occupy yourselves with them, and try your best, apply all power and ability, and you will find so much to do that you will neither seek nor esteem any other work or holiness. Let this be sufficient concerning the first part of the common Christian doctrine, both for teaching and urging what is necessary. In conclusion, however, we must repeat the text which belongs here, of which we have treated already in the first commandment, in order that we may learn what pains God requires to the end we may learn to inculcate and practice the Ten Commandments. For I, the Lord, thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Although, as we have heard above, this appendix was primarily attached to the first commandment, it was, nevertheless, we cannot deny that it was, laid down for the sake of all the commandments, as all of them are to be referred and directed to it. Therefore, I have said that this, too, should be presented to and inculcated upon the young, that they may learn and remember it, in order to see what is to urge and compel us to keep these Ten Commandments. And it is to be regarded as though this part were specially added to each, so that it inheres in and pervades them all. Now, there is comprehended in these words, as said before, both an angry word of threatening and a friendly promise to terrify and warn us, and, moreover, to induce and encourage us to receive and highly esteem his word as a matter of divine earnestness, because he himself declares how much he is concerned about it, and how rigidly he will enforce it, namely, that he will horribly and terribly punish all who despise and transgress his commandments. And again, how richly he will reward, bless, and do all good to those who hold them in high esteem and gladly do and live according to them. Thus, he demands that all our works proceed from a heart which fears and regards God alone, and from such fear avoids everything that is contrary to his will, lest it should move him to wrath, and, on the other hand, also trusts in him alone, and from love to him does all he wishes, because he speaks to us as friendly as a father, and offers us all grace and every good. Just this is also the meaning and true interpretation of the first and chief commandment, from which all the others must flow and proceed, so that this word, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," in its simplest meaning, states nothing else than this demand: "Thou shalt fear, love, and trust in me as thine only true God." For where there is a heart thus disposed towards God, the same has fulfilled this and all the other commandments. On the other hand, whoever fears and loves anything else in heaven and upon earth will keep neither this nor any. Thus the entire scriptures have everywhere preached and inculcated this commandment, aiming always at these two things: fear of God and trust in Him. And especially the prophet David throughout the Psalms, as when he says, Psalm 147:11, "The Lord taketh pleasure in them that fear Him, in those that hope in His mercy." As if the entire commandment were explained by one verse, as much as to say, "The Lord taketh pleasure in those who have no other gods." Thus, the first commandment is to shine and impart its splendor to all the others. Therefore, you must let this declaration run through all the commandments, like a hoop in a wreath, joining the end to the beginning and holding them all together, that it be continually repeated and not forgotten, as, namely, in the second commandment, that we fear God and do not take His name in vain for cursing, lying, deceiving, and other modes of leading men astray or rascality, but make proper and good use of it by calling upon Him in prayer, praise, and thanksgiving, derived from love and trust according to the first commandment. In like manner, such fear, love, and trust is to urge and force us not to despise His word, but gladly to learn, hear, and esteem it holy and honor it. Thus, continuing through all the following commandments towards our neighbor, likewise, everything is to proceed by virtue of the first commandment, to wit, that we honor father and mother, masters and all in authority, and be subject and obedient to them, not on their own account, but for God's sake. For you are not to regard or fear father or mother, or from love of them do or omit anything, but to see that which God would have you do, and what He will quite surely demand of you. If you omit that, you have an angry judge, but in the contrary case, a gracious Father. Again, that you do your neighbor no harm, injury, or violence, nor in any wise encroach upon him as touching his body, wife, property, honor, or rights, as all these things are commanded in their order, even though you have opportunity and cause to do so, and no man would reprove you, but that you do good to all men, help them, and promote their interest, howsoever and wherever you can, purely from love of God and in order to please Him, in the confidence that He will abundantly reward you for everything. Thus you see how the first commandment is the chief source and fountainhead which flows into all the rest, and again, all return to that and depend upon it, so that beginning and end are fastened and bound to each other. This, I say, it is profitable and necessary always to teach to the young people, to admonish them and to remind them of it, that they may be brought up not only with blows and compulsion like cattle, but in the fear and reverence of God. For where this is considered and laid to heart, that these things are not human trifles, but the commandments of the Divine Majesty, who insists upon them with such earnestness, is angry with and punishes those who despise them, and, on the other hand, abundantly rewards those who keep them, there will be a spontaneous impulse and a desire gladly to do the will of God. Therefore, it is not in vain that it is commanded in the Old Testament to write the Ten Commandments on all walls and corners, yes, even on the garments, not for the sake of merely having them written in these places and making a show of them, as did the Jews, but that we might have our eyes continually fixed upon them and have them always in our memory, and that we might practice them in all our actions and ways, and everyone make them his daily exercise in all cases, in every business and transaction, as though they were written in every place, wherever he would look, yea, wherever he walks or stands. Thus there would be occasion enough, both at home in our own house, and abroad with our neighbors, to practice the Ten Commandments, that no one need run far for them. From this, it again appears how highly these Ten Commandments are to be exalted and extolled above all estates, commandments, and works which are taught and practiced aside from them. For here we can boast and say, let all the wise and saints step forth and produce, if they can, a single work like these commandments, upon which God insists with such earnestness, and which he enjoins with his greatest wrath and punishment, and, besides, adds such glorious promises that he will pour out upon us all good things and blessings. Therefore, they should be taught above all others, and be esteemed precious and dear as the highest treasure given by God.